or WLC prior to the effective date of the statute, that those claims could also be brought. So we're looking at decades, potentially tens of thousands of cases involving pre-2011 exposures. In the case of latent injuries and minors, those could extend for an entire generation. And the Wisconsin legislature was thus faced with a choice. What do we do when we're trying to restore the common law back to its traditional roots, to its principles, but it would be ineffective because we have this gap and there's potentially tens of thousands of cases over the next generation coming forward? It would thwart the legislative intent and expand risk contribution in a way that they thought was improper, probably unconstitutional, and would violate Wisconsin public policy.
Do you know how many cases for claimed lead poisoning were filed that would still fit under the initial statute that was enacted before the 2013 amendment?
Well, there was almost 200 that were filed prior to the 2011 statute taking effect.
I thought you told me that they were not all white lead carbonate.
No, oh, non-white lead carbonate. There was
That's
at least
what I was
six.
Curious about.
I apologize, Your Honor. There's at least six claims, lawsuits over. Many of them included 30 or 35 defendants. They were asbestos cases. They were benzene cases. They were solvent cases.
Thank
it's
you.
Not just white lead carbonate. And what the legislature was faced with was the prospect of going forward, companies, manufacturers having to defend. Spend millions of dollars on these cases, defending them in a way that they believed would be unfair, improper, and against public policy of the state of Wisconsin. And in passing the 2013 legislation, the legislature weighed the balance of the public interests and the private interests, and it concluded that the manufacturers reasonably relied on the traditional common law, which Thomas had changed. And it concluded it was unfair and disproportional liability, and that it was necessary to pass a law to protect Wisconsin's economy. In contrast, what the legislature determined is that plaintiffs had no settled expectations in Thomas. It was a recent decision. It was heavily criticized. And in 2013, when the law was passed, it was speculative to whether it was even good law. District court at that time had held it to be unconstitutional. There's nothing unfair about requiring...
As you're going through, I understand what you're saying and how you're setting up the landscape for rational basis and that. But the one thing that's bothering me in this case is the fact that at the time this particular plaintiff filed her lawsuit, the law was Thomas, whether you like it or not. And so how can it be that the legislature can unwind that with subsequent legislation? So from my perspective, you're going to have to focus on the retroactive application, not just because of rational basis and is there a good reason for them doing that, but whether or not there's a vested right in knowing what the law is at the time you file a lawsuit.
Sure, Your Honor. Vested rights are based on settled expectations. And there was no settled expectation that a plaintiff could ever rely on Thomas and take it to verdict. This court...
Why was there no settled expectation? It was the final decision of this court.
But there were many open-ended questions, Your Honor. In fact, this court in 2005 took the extraordinary step of creating a rule and then suggesting that it was potentially unconstitutional and potentially violate public policy. It left those issues open, and when we've looked...
I thought Thomas went to trial. Am I mistaken about that?
Thomas went to trial, and the jury found that there was no harm to Mr. Thomas.
Based on the white lead carbonate.
Risk contribution was decided on a summary judgment procedure when it was up here before this court. Right. And this court left open final issues that would resolve whether or not it was a pending cause of action at all. Constitutionality.
Okay, but Thomas went to trial. If they were such open issues, why weren't they litigated before they took it to the jury?
Well, those issues eventually were litigated in the Gibson case, and they were litigated in public policy. We're still waiting to litigate.
Well, you know, most decisions that come down aren't wrapped in a neat package. They're always, I mean, you folks would be out of business if there weren't always evolving issues when something happens legally, right? I mean, you never have a case that, I shouldn't say never because that's a bad word in the law, but it's rare that you have a decision that ties everything that could possibly be argued about a particular claim up in a tight package, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, but you're looking at settled expectations. What are the settled expectations of Clark at the time she filed the lawsuit? And at the time she filed the lawsuit, legislator passed a law that tried to undo Thomas. Immediately, before the ink was hardly dry on the opinion,
it was
vetoed by the
governor.
That
was January 27, 2011. Isn't that when they passed the first law?
No, in 2005, the legislature passed a law. It was vetoed by the governor. 2011, they come back and they pass
it. That's not a law. When it gets vetoed by the governor, it's done.
You are correct, Your Honor, but we're talking about settled expectations. What can reasonably be relied upon? And Ms. Clark, in 2006, could not reasonably rely on the Thomas decision.
Well, why not?
Because there was open-ended issues.
The concept in the common law is when the court makes a common law decision, it dates back forever because the court found what was there, the brooding omnipresence of the law. So Thomas was a decision that dated back so that when Ms. Clark was injured, that decision was already in effect.
It was not vested, Your Honor. And Ms. Clark had an injury in 2003, which was an indivisible injury, and this court looks to what is the law at the time of the injury? And Thomas wasn't on the books. It was 2 years away.
No, but it doesn't matter. The court finds the common law, and it is always there. It's just we got smart enough to find it. I mean, that's the concept of the common law.
But that's different than vested rights, which is a determination as to settled expectations. And Clark didn't have a settled expectation.
The general rule about vested rights is the right is vested at the time of injury and the conduct, right?
Correct.
Which you say is 2003.
Which is 2003. And you look at the settled expectations at that time.
Why not 2006? Seems to me she was living in another place, and she was also treated for lead poisoning in 2006.
Right.
Why not 2006?
Because you have a single course of conduct with an indivisible injury that occurred in
two buildings.
But that's for my defense. You have two landlord cases.
Sure.
But you have one case against my client, which is a single course of conduct.
Counsel, on that point, and this is going to go directly, you've made the point a couple of times, indivisible injury. Reading the circuit court's decision and order in the matter, on page 11, the circuit court said the plaintiff conceded his point that it was indivisible. My eye is drawn to page 52 in the appendix, which is page 11 of the transcript, and there it seemed the plaintiff continued to take issue with the idea of it being one indivisible injury starting in 03. How do I reconcile that?
Well, I think, Your Honor, under this court's case law, that as soon a cause of action accrues when you have an injury and a suable party, and in this case that happened in 2003. And when you have an indivisible injury, this is no different than a worker who's exposed to benzene in multiple different locations during a workplace, they still have one cause of action that would accrue because it's an indivisible injury. But more importantly, and I want to get to 2013, because even if the court finds that there isn't a single injury, in 2013, when the legislature passed this law, the Gibson District Court had declared it to be unconstitutional, declared Thomas to be unconstitutional. The legislature was stepping in and leaving open and deciding the issue that this court left open in Thomas, which is what is the public policy of the state of Wisconsin. And it determined that it did not want to have risk contribution to continue for decades. And that Thomas was the first part of a dialogue between this court and the legislature. And the legislature, whether the court agrees with it or disagrees with it, decided that there was a need to be resolved here and to step in. And at that time, Thomas was not fully set up. This isn't like a statute of limitations or economic damages caps that this court has looked at in the past for retroactivity. This is much more akin to the case of In Re Paternity John R.B., which that case dealt with the child support law that had changed. And there was a discretionary payment mechanism by which a petitioner could contend that we had a private contract and that therefore the court should enter that as discretionary and approve that contract. It was taken away, and the court said it was contingent. It was a weak private interest. We have the exact same thing here. Fundamental issues regarding constitutionality, public policy, were left open. They were not decided.
Well, I you're losing me on your argument, and maybe you can address my concern, and then we might be on the same page. She filed her claim in 2006.
Correct.
At that time, no statute precluded her claim, and our decision said, yes, it was a valid claim, correct? So the day she filed it, it was a valid claim. Now, you may say there were issues that were outstanding. Well, they certainly weren't litigated out in Thomas. They took it all the way to trial. That there could be issues raised contrary to risk contribution theory, fine. I don't have a problem with that. That doesn't mean our decision isn't settled until some other decision takes it apart or some statute takes it apart.
Your Honor, what Thomas said is that there may be a risk contribution theory under the white lead carpet. It had not decided issues such as fungibility of the product, which the court assumed all of the facts in favor of the plaintiffs and left open for another day whether it actually would apply to the particulars of that case. And these issues were litigated in Thomas. They weren't resolved finally because it did go to jury, and the jury found in favor of the defendants. Had the jury not found in favor of defendants, these issues would have gone up to the appellate courts years before. They're just percolating up now. But constitutionality, we have not found a case in which this court created a rule and said, we're uncertain if it's constitutional. That's extraordinary.
Is a vested right determined as of the date you file a lawsuit or the date of the loss?
It is the date of the injury, is when the court looks to vested right, because it looks at the settled expectations of the party. And even if the court were to find that there is a vested right, it still has to balance those rights and against the legislature's interest in restoring the common law. This is not a case where the legislature changed the law. They were restoring it to what it's been for the last 150 years in the state of Wisconsin. And what they've held is that it's not unfair to make a plaintiff bear the same burden of proof that every other plaintiff outside of the unique situation of Collins has had to bear, which is to identify a specific manufacturer who created the product that harmed her.
What's your best case? I'm sorry. What is your best case to support that proposition that filing isn't what matters, it's the date of the loss?
The date of loss is the Martin case, for example. It discusses that very clearly. Holyfield also discusses that. The Seventh Circuit faced a similar situation here in Kopech versus the city of Elmhurst. And in that case, you had an ADA immunity for cities and municipalities that said you can basically discriminate on the basis of age because firefighters and whatnot, we want to give that to them. Congress, that expired, and there became a time period where it was against the law to discriminate on the basis of age. A couple years later, Congress passed a law again, and they eliminated that gap. And the Seventh Circuit said that's perfectly rational. There was a plaintiff who said, I was discriminated in that gap when it was illegal to bring a claim or illegal to discriminate on the basis of my age. I have a claim. And the court said there's a rational basis to have a comprehensive effect in order to have to eliminate the gap in the statute. And the Supreme Court in the Landsgraf case mentioned correcting a mistake, comprehensive effect, closing a gap. Those are all rational basis upon which a statute can be affirmed. And in this case, where you have a burden of proof from the plaintiffs, they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the legislature acted irrationally here. And I would suggest that's not possible.
Before you step down, what is your best case that says she did not have a vested right in 2006 when she filed this lawsuit? What's your best case?
My best case would be probably In Re Fraternity, In Re the Fraternity of John R. B.
Okay.
The Kopech case is also applicable there.
Thank you.
Deputy Solicitor General Luke Berg, on behalf of the Attorney General, and may it please the Court. The law in this case is unique in that it undoes a recent court decision that substantially altered the common law and had a significant retroactive effect. Now, this court's normal concerns about the unfairness of overturning settled expectations actually cut in the opposite direction in this case. They strongly favor the retroactive law because it does far more to restore settled expectations than it does to upset them.
Do you agree that the date that we look at for vested interest is the date of injury?
Yes, I agree that that's consistent with this court's precedent.
Do you agree that the activity, despite the separate 2006 alleged injury, is one indivisible injury going to the 2003 date?
I think that's a really tough question. I think the vested rights question is a really tough inquiry, and that's why the state has not taken a position on that inquiry. We think the simplest and cleanest way to resolve this case is to hold that the law easily passes this court's rational basis balancing test, because both public and private interests weigh heavily in favor of the law here. With respect to the public interests, the law is important because it reassures all of Wisconsin's citizens that they can rely on settled law. Businesses and individuals need to know that they're not suddenly going to be held liable for the conduct of somebody else a century ago. Now, the law here needed to be retroactive because it was the only way to reset the common law to what it had always been. If the legislature had only overruled Thomas prospectively, it would provide little comfort because the lawsuits filed in that gap period could be devastating. So part of what provides confidence in settled law in Wisconsin is the fact that there are two checks on retroactive changes in the law, both this court and the legislature. Normally, the legislature doesn't pass retroactive laws, but if it does, this court steps in and will often nullify any retroactive effect. In this case, it's the same, but the roles are reversed. That's what's interesting. This court changed the law retroactively and substantially in Thomas, and the legislature stepped in and nullified that effect.
Well, the legislature started out by nullifying the effect prospectively.
Yes,
right?
That's true. Yes.
In 2011, I think. And then in 2013, they put in the budget bill a little add-on to that law. Would you address for me why that add-on isn't focused on the white lead carbonate plaintiffs who had filed the lawsuit that I understand are six?
As counsel for the manufacturers pointed out, a lot of cases have been filed in contexts other than white lead carbonate.
I'm only interested in that context.
I know, but you asked why the law wasn't just focused on that.
I said my question poorly. In regard to white lead carbonate claims, why isn't the change in the law that was in the budget bill simply focused on those, I understand, six plaintiffs who filed a claim saying they had lead poisoning due to white lead carbonate?
Because it was a general change in the law that eliminated not only white lead carbonate claims, but also any other claims that were filed under the Thomas theory. And so it was a broad, generally applicable change in the law that needed to be retroactive because it was the only way that the court could, or that the legislature could fully reset the common law to what it had always been.
Settled expectations are we concerned with? The defendants or the plaintiffs?
So that raises a really good point, that question does. And normally, when the law changes retroactively, there's only one set of unsettled expectations that matters. That's because the side that benefits from the change in the law gets something that it never expected. It gets a windfall. But in cases like this, the circumstances are unique because when a law undoes a recent decision that was itself severely retroactive, there's actually two sets of unsettled expectations that are relevant. There's both the unsettled expectations of the plaintiffs in this case, but there's also the unsettled expectations that are being restored by the law. So in this case, there's no way to avoid upsetting some legal expectation. This court must either reimpose Thomas's dramatic retroactive effects on the manufacturers, or it must uphold the mild retroactive effect on the plaintiffs. You have to consider both unsettled.
What's so mild about the plaintiffs getting hurt? You've got As I remember, Thomas, you had a situation where for many, many, many years, the manufacturers denied any problem with the lead, right? Even though there was evidence, a lot of evidence to the contrary, it was buried, right? That's from the manufacturer's standpoint. And what you had from the plaintiff's standpoint was that children were being severely damaged, not for a year or two, but for the rest of their lives, right?
I think it's important to emphasize here that this court is not reanalyzing the policy issue that was at issue in Thomas.
Well,
the court
but
is not
you said that we are, because we are making a balance now between the interest of the public and the interest of the private victims, which is all of us, potentially. And that's what is argued here. That's the balance under Matthews, Martin, et cetera.
With all due respect, I disagree. I think the balancing here is a much narrower inquiry.
Okay.
All you're balancing here is the degree to which the retroactive change unsettles important rights. And here you have two unsettled rights that we're talking about. You have the plaintiff's unsettled rights, their interest in this six-year claim that sort of existed in a quasi-uncertain state, versus the settled interests of the manufacturers, which had existed for a century and were unsettled in Thomas but are being restored by the law here. As between the two, there is no doubt that a century of reliance on traditional law outweighs whatever reliance developed in the short 6 years that Thomas was viable.
There was a risk contribution case before Thomas, right, that dealt with DES, right?
Yep. Collins case, yeah. That's
yes.
Right.
What year was that?
1984, I believe.
Okay. So that would let everybody know there's a risk contribution doctrine in the state.
The
right?
Circumstances of DES are dramatically different than those in the lead paint cases, so it would not have put the manufacturers on notice that it would be applied to lead paint, and regardless, most of the conduct we're talking about here occurred long before even Collins was issued. We're talking about conduct going back to 1900. So that's multiple generations before even Collins was issued.
And,
so
when did the paint industry know that it was dangerous, because lead was dangerous?
I don't think that's clear at all. The only case that made it to a jury in Wisconsin on that issue, the jury found that the manufacturer didn't in fact know that lead paint caused the damage that it has caused. So I don't think it's clear at all that the lead paint industry knew that lead paint had the effect that it has. I want to emphasize here that what we're asking for is a very narrow holding. There's a lot of circumstances in this case that are unique that, if different, could change the outcome of this case. If, for example, Thomas was a much older case and more reliance on it had developed, this could be a different case. If Thomas didn't have a significant retroactive effect, if it only applied to conduct going forward, this could be a different case. If Thomas was a standard statutory interpretation case and didn't look as much like significant lawmaking, this could be a different case.
What exactly is the test that you're proposing the court use? I hear you say vested interest. Interesting question, doesn't have to be decided because there's a rational basis here and the legislature can do that. Are there no checks on the rational basis?
There certainly are. We just think that this court's balancing test in the unique circumstances of this case weighs strongly in favor of the law here because the unique circumstances are you have a recent court decision, one that existed in an uncertain state for a brief 6 years. It was a substantial alteration of the common law.
But I hear you talking about settled expectations, and that is part of vested interest, isn't it?
Yes.
But the other part of me hears you say, vested interest, interesting issue, might be able to go either way, decide this just based upon rational basis. What's the legal framework that we decide this under? Does it have to be vested interest, and if there's a vested interest, then the rational basis overcomes that? Is it just the rational basis test no matter what? Is it assume without deciding that there's a vested interest, but nonetheless the rational basis test applies? If that's the case, then vested interest really doesn't mean much, right? Because all you do is apply the rational basis test. Are you understanding my question?
Yeah, it's the last one that you said. Assume without deciding that there's a vested interest, because it's much easier and clearer to decide that this law passes the rational basis test. I think in some cases, the vested interest portion of the inquiry will matter and be relevant, but in this case, it's much harder to decide that step of the inquiry than it is the rational basis test.
In what case do you rely on for the balancing?
I think all of, well, I see that my light is on. May I answer?
Please.
I think all of this court's cases strongly support our position. Now, most of this court's cases went the other way, but the reasons that this court gave for overturning retroactive laws actually cut in the opposite direction here, because this law does a lot more to restore settled expectations than it does to upset them.
You know, why isn't the balance in the eye of the beholder? In other words, what may feel to me to be a real burden on the defendant may to someone else feel to be a greater burden on the plaintiff, who's analyzing the same rational basis test that is set out in all of our opinions when we look back at a statute that's retroactively applied. What are the secure posts that we can rely on so it's not just whoever happens to be looking at it at that particular day's decision? Am I making any sense?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't think there are many. There are many tight holes on that test.
Yeah, there's a certain degree to which the test is subjective and
right.
can be applied differently depending on who looks at it. But I think the simplest way to see it in this case is you have a brief 6-year period that Thomas existed. Hardly any reliance could have developed in 6 years versus a century, a full 100 years that manufacturers relied on traditional common law, tort law principles. Take 6 years against 100 years, it's just not even close. So that's why I think this case is so clear that the rational basis test is passed.
It seems to me that you are paying little attention to the Collins case. I remember when the Gibson case came out and seeing the comments of the Seventh Circuit about the existence of risk contribution theory in the state of Wisconsin since the Collins case in 1984. And I also note, as was referenced earlier, page 11 appendix 027, page 11 of the analysis of the circuit court, I think it is, in Milwaukee. And it said this about Collins. Collins left the door open for expansion of the risk contribution theory in other factually similar scenarios. That is, unique situations where, quote, entirely innocent plaintiffs may have been severely harmed by a product they had no control over, and they may never know or be able to prove with certainty which company produced or marketed the product. Collins at 190 and 191 is cited. So it seems to me that it's not all over 100 years in 1984. There's the possibility that beyond DES, which was the subject of the Collins case, that the recognized risk contribution theory may apply in unique situations, quote, where entirely innocent plaintiffs may have been severely harmed by a product. Now, that doesn't say we're keeping this open for white lead carbonate, of course. But nor does it mean that people shouldn't be aware that the risk contribution theory had the potential to be expanded beyond DES with that language in the Collins case. So how can you rest so soundly on this idea that over for 100 years people were saying
that they could rely that there would be no risk contribution theory?
A few responses. Even if you think that 1984 is the relevant date,
for many reasons,
that the law
George
changed.
George Orwell and
a lot of the conduct that we're talking about was in the early 1900s. Lead paint was banned in the 70s and 80s, and most of the manufacturers that are defendants here stopped producing it long before that. So it's not fair to say that they were warned about even Collins. And second, I think the white lead carbonate context is vastly different from the DES context. I think even the majority in Thomas acknowledged that. They called their holding an extension
of Collins. Yes.
And so white lead carbonate manufacturers, having looked at all of the factors that the court discussed in Collins, would reasonably have thought that that case wouldn't apply to their context because it's different. The legislature's law here leaves open the risk contribution theory for DES cases. So clearly there is something that distinguishes those cases from this one. Otherwise it wouldn't be possible to leave it open for those cases, but not for white lead carbonate. So I still think the relevant time period is 6 years versus 100.
Could I ask you, can you think of any statute where there has been retroactive application that is comparable to the statute at issue here?
I searched a lot of cases nationwide. I haven't been able to find a case with circumstances as unique as this, where you have a very recent court decision that substantially altered the common law and had a significant retroactive effect. I haven't been able to find a single case that addressed circumstances like this. And that's why we think this case is unique. We think if there's ever an appropriate time for the legislature to retroactively overrule a court decision, this is it. This is at the far end of the spectrum. There are no further
questions. What about?
If Thomas had still been pending at the time that this legislation was passed, the 2013, would Thomas have been affected?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question. If Thomas was pending?
Yeah.
At the trial court level, you mean, right, Justice Prosser?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Our decision was out, but they were at the trial court level. Could you have shut down Thomas then?
Yes, I think so.
Law?
Yes. I think the legislature can pass laws of general applicability that can have effect on any case that has not reached a final judgment. Obviously, once Thomas reached a final judgment, then the legislature can't undo that. But there are no further
questions. But pending action, the legislature can pluck the case.
Yes.
What's your authority? What's the case that you rely on for that premise?
Well, there's actually a case before the Supreme Court right now called Bank Markazi, where the issue in the case is whether the legislature can specifically direct the outcome in one case, and that the Supreme Court thinks that's a close question. This isn't even close to that. So I think
You're directing it in six.
I don't think it is. It's changing a general rule of applicability that affects not only these six cases but any case that relied on Thomas. That's very different than directing the outcome of a specific case.
Probably depends to some degree on how you interpret the statute, though.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have any idea what the cite is to that case?
The Bank Markazi case?
Yeah.
No, I'm afraid not. I can provide
it
afterwards.
I'll try to find it. My clerk can find it, I'm
right.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a long way down. May it please the court. I am Peter Earle of the Law Offices of Peter Earle in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I have the privilege of introducing today my colleague, Fidelma Fitzpatrick from the law firm of Motley Rice out of Providence, Rhode Island. Ms. Fitzpatrick will address the separations of powers issues that we raised in our brief, and I will address, after she finishes, the issues that you've been talking about on substantive due process, vested rights, and the balancing test.
Very good. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Thank you for the opportunity to address you today on this important issue. And I believe in the last 5 minutes, it was crystallized exactly what the appellants are asking this court to do here. And what they're asking is for this court to allow the legislature to retroactively overrule one of your decisions because they don't like it. That's an enormous separation of powers issue. This isn't a case about restoring the common law. This isn't a case about this court looking at the application of risk contribution and other aspects. This is a case where the legislature has taken it upon itself to pass a statute that says, you, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin, got it wrong, and we're going to substitute our interpretation of the law, and much more importantly, our interpretation of the Constitution for yours.
Well, doesn't the legislature do it all the time? Maybe not to us, but I tell you what, in the 8 years I've been here, I've seen any number of times where authors of majority of opinions have invited the legislature to take a look and say, hey, if you think we got it wrong, if you don't like the result, you can certainly take a look, and if we didn't interpret the law correctly, you can correct. I mean, I don't see anything. Your tone is, and demeanor are kind of indicating great umbrage on our behalf, but it happens quite frequently.
It doesn't happen the way it has here, Your Honor. And here's why. Your role in the separation of powers, there are three branches of government. You alone have the ability to interpret the laws, and most important, you alone have the ability to interpret the Constitution of Wisconsin. That is only your responsibility. That is not anything that the legislature has any ability to do.
Well, in fact, when we developed through the common law torts liabilities, the legislature is certainly free. Are you getting at something?
Yes,
they did something improper? I mean,
yes, Your Honor, and here's why it's improper. The Thomas Court, when you decided Thomas in 2005, this court did two things. And the first was very important. This court looked at Article 1, Section 9 of the Wisconsin Constitution. And this court made a determination that under Article 1, Section 9 of the Wisconsin Constitution, that lead-poisoned children had a right to a remedy for the wrong that had been committed to them by the lead pigment manufacturers. That was an interpretation of the constitutional provision. That right exists. It's a substantive right. This court recognized it. The court then went on to do a second thing, which is to say that the remedy that was available to lead-poisoned children was a remedy under risk contribution, which had been adopted in 1984 and was the established common law of the state of Wisconsin at the time the Thomas decision was decided. And most importantly, what this court did in footnote number 26 in paragraph 122 of the Thomas decision, is this court recognized that while the legislature can change the common law, any changes to the common law had to respect this court's interpretation of Article 1, Section 9, and the rights that lead-poisoned children had. In other words, while the legislature could change the common law, what the legislature could not do was abrogate a remedy and leave lead-poisoned children without a remedy for the wrong that had been committed to them by the lead manufacturers. And this legislation does exactly that. This legislation leaves lead...
Can I just clarify something, then? Are you asking that we declare the statute unconstitutional?
I believe that the statute, as it is drafted and as it is written, is unconstitutional.
Not just to these plaintiffs, but unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. It needs to be thrown out, the statute.
I believe that the statute, as it applies to lead-poisoned children, violates this court's finding of their constitutional rights under Article 1, Section 9.
I just wanted to clarify that that's indeed what you were saying.
Okay.
So it's rather... A circumscribed group that you're saying it would be having unconstitutional application to.
It does. Well, it's the reason that it's a separation of powers argument is that this court has already declared that it is a substantive right of lead poisoned children to seek a remedy.
That's right. I understand that. I'm saying, and that's your circumscribed group, that is, children who have been subject to lead poisoning.
That's correct, because that's the group that Thomas looked at. And so that's the only substantive right under Article 1, Section 9 that this court has passed on in that way.
Are you saying the statute's unconstitutional prospectively?
It's not in front of the court today whether the statute is unconstitutional prospectively.
How could we reconcile it otherwise? I mean, respectfully, I hear you saying when we rely on our state constitution, engage in new federalism, the legislature can't do a thing about it.
No, what I'm saying is that when you declare the constitutional rights of a group of people, the legislature can't come in and do what it's done right here, which is, and they say it in the legislative intent, you got it wrong. It is your sole discretion to decide how the laws are interpreted and how the laws are applied and how the Constitution is applied. The legislature cannot come in and say, we want to overrule you, which is essentially what this argument is. The legislature doesn't have the ability to be a supreme body that sits above this court, and every time you issue a decision that the legislature doesn't like, it has the ability to come in and its legislative findings say, we believe that the court's interpretation of the law of Wisconsin is wrong, therefore we're going to pass a statute to fix what they did. That is an absolute, complete violation of the separation of powers issues. There's no doubt here. Obviously, the legislature doesn't like what you did in Thomas.
Are you arguing that the statute then is unconstitutional as applied to these children?
I believe that the statute deprives these children of the Article 1, Section 9 rights this court vested with them and recognized in clearly in the Thomas decision, and most specifically at footnote 26 of that decision.
So is the answer to my question yes or no?
Yes.
Yes, but more than that, unless I'm getting your argument wrong, which is why I pressed you on that, you're really saying it's facially unconstitutional.
It is
for
facially.
It is
facially unconstitutional.
Because Thomas has to remain good law, is what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that Thomas has to remain the law, but the method under which the legislature undertook this legislation, the findings of this legislation, which is the only thing that is before the court, and the way the legislature went about dealing with this problem through this legislation is facially unconstitutional. I am not here, we never say never. I can't think of all the permutations of what the legislature may or may not do.
So it's not just an as-applied challenge, it's a facial
challenge. Facially unconstitutional cannot be constitutionally applied to anyone.
That is correct.
That's
okay,
correct.
But unless I miss your argument, you're not arguing for how this statute fits with folks that may have problems with asbestos. And you're not arguing about how this statute fits with folks that may have ingested something else. The world is full of things you oughtn't get but tend to. Okay? So that's why I phrased my question to, was it as applied to those folks poisoned by white lead carbonate? Now, you answered Justice Ziegler's question much more broadly than that.
You have corrected me, Your Honor. And when you ask a question like that, it is unconstitutional as it is applied to lead poisoned children because of the constitutional right that this court recognized that those children have under Article 1, Section 9. The statute as applied to those children is unconstitutional because it deprives them of the remedy that this court recognized was required in order to fulfill their constitutional rights.
Well, then wouldn't the relief that you would be seeking here would not be for us to assume that the legislature got it wrong, but someone would have to bring a lawsuit where we would then review the statute in particular?
Well, I think that's exactly what's in front of Your Honors with respect to the lead-poisoned children. With respect to, and I'll be honest, I haven't followed whether it's been utilized in asbestos or solvents or anything else. Those aren't my clients. Those are not individuals I represent, so I can't make any representations to Your Honors about the constitutionality of the statute as it applies to those individuals.
Well, typically the governor would be put on notice, the secretary of the Department of Administration would be put on notice, there would be a lawsuit directly challenging the statute. That's not what this case is.
Well, you're correct. And when I was asked about whether prospect, this statute could survive prospectively, I was careful to say I recognize this was before the court today, is whether this statute can bar Ms. Clark's cause of action and can be applied to the facts of this particular case, because that's the way this question has come up. And the answer to that is it cannot be applied to Ms. Clark's cause of action, because what it does is it strips her of her constitutional right under Thomas to a right to a remedy. That's not a new law. That's not a change in the law. That's not something distinct or out of the blue, as the appellants here suggest. But as to Ms. Clark, you have already said that she has a substantive right. This court has said she has a substantive right to a remedy for these lead poisoning wrongs. And this court has also explicitly rejected the very argument and the very rationale that the legislature has put in, which is, it's no big deal, she can sue the landlord. That was the precise issue that this court wrestled with and decided in the Thomas decision when it said Article 1, Section 9 has to be interpreted in such a way as to provide a remedy for every wrong, the wrong committed by the lead pigment manufacturers and separately the wrong that's committed by the landlords. And her ability to pursue a landlord remedy doesn't fulfill the constitutional right that she has to pursue a cause of action against these lead pigment manufacturers. The legislature told you they disagree, and so they passed legislation that undoes your interpretation of the Constitution, which is absolutely barred by the separation of powers doctrine.
It sounds to me that you're asking for a rather limited opinion, that the limited opinion you're asking for, and we may get to a different kind of discussion with Mr. Earle, but the limited opinion you're asking for is that the legislature cannot retroactively change a decision of this court on lead paint.
I believe that is what is in front of the court.
I understand that, but that's all that you're arguing. You're not arguing that they can never change a court decision.
No.
Obviously they can, and they could have adopted this. It appears as if they could say prospectively, no risk contribution in Wisconsin, just like prospectively, no joint and several liability.
I'm not questioning the legislature's ability to change the common law. Okay. That is established, and I'm not suggesting that they can't.
All right.
But what I am suggesting is the change in the common law can't impinge on constitutional rights that this court has already recognized.
And this is the constitutional right in 1, Section 9, and it relates only to lead paint, as far as you're concerned.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that's the only, that's why I say it's very limited. And doesn't this court, if it's going to look at constitutionality, look at the issue in a limited way, and you decide cases so you don't raise constitutional issues?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And as I read Matheson, is it Matheson? Matthews, I guess it is. That's what applied the balancing test.
Right. So Mr. Earle is going to address the substantive due process.
Okay.
There's the first issue, which is this is a complete deprivation of a constitutional right. The second issue we get to is the balancing test for substantive due process analysis.
And it applies when it's retroactive and vested. That's what happened in Matthews. You look to balancing.
Right. And when you're looking at a retroactive application under substantive due process, there's a balancing test that needs to happen.
Under sub 5, there's a change in the statute of limitations so that it says that a person cannot be liable under the provision set out in the statute if more than 25 years have passed between the date of manufacture, distributor, seller, and so forth, and the product that allegedly caused the claimant's injury. And my question to you is,
is that statute of limitations, in your view, permissible, or does it get tied up in the same problems you've been describing generally for a remedy?
Right. So this will impose a statute of repose here.
Yes.
And that is not constitutional because the result of that legislation is to leave lead poisoned children without an ability to seek a remedy for their Article 1, Section 9 substantive right.
Counsel, I have to ask you one question. I know your red light is on, but if the legislature can't change Supreme Court precedent, the court can, right? So presumably, counsel will argue that we ought to vacate that reference to the state constitution. Do you have a response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. There is no doubt that this court has the ability to overrule its prior precedent, Thomas, if it should so choose. As this court has noted, and most recently noted in about 2015, the concept, though, of stare decisis will apply. The court's rule is not to revise prior precedent at a whim. It has to be something for a very heightened reason. And the court found that deciding cases, if we change them and alter them at a whim, that deciding cases becomes a mere exercise of judicial whim with arbitrary and unpredictable results.
And I'm not talking about the case, but the reference to the Constitution. Couldn't that case rest on its own without reference to the Constitution?
The Thomas decision? The Thomas decision, no, because the Thomas decision, the two decisions were intertwined. So
I thought it was an expansion of Collins, an expansion of precedent.
It was an application of Collins to the facts of that case. It was not an expansion of Collins because, as we've noted in 1984, this court made clear, while it was applying Collins to the facts of the DES, it was the law of the state and could be applied under other factually applicable scenarios. Lead happens to be one of those factually applicable scenarios that came
was
before the
Collins
court.
Was Collins constitutionally based on the Wisconsin Constitution as well?
It all goes back to the Article 1, Section 9, the right to a remedy. That's the reason for the risk contribution
So Thomas
doctrine.
Could rest on Collins without an additional reference to the Constitution.
Collins rested on
it could, but it didn't because the Thomas decision found explicitly that Article 1, Section 9 applies to lead-poisoned children and their right to a remedy. So it made a decision that was based solely on the facts of lead poisoning as they existed in the state and said, having found that Article 1, Section 9 gives a substantive constitutional right to these children, it then turned to what remedy is there available under the Wisconsin common law, and the Wisconsin common law at that time recognized risk contribution.
All right, just to be clear, so Thomas couldn't come out the way it came out without relying on the Wisconsin Constitution?
I don't believe that it could.
Okay.
Let me see. I want to make sure I understand exactly what the right is in Article 1, Section 9. Let's say we're in 1980. If there was some lead poisoning and we knew that all the paint in a particular place where the victim had lived had been manufactured by Sherwin-Williams, going back to whenever Sherwin-Williams was founded, wouldn't there have been a remedy there?
For that individual child, yes, a remedy would have existed with product manufacture, the product identification. Those are not the facts, though, of lead poisoning, and because of the fungibility of the products, the interchangeable nature of the products, it's not possible to do that. In an ideal world, that's the way it would be done, but that's not possible under the
statute. Did we decide fungibility in that case?
I'm sorry.
Did we decide fungibility?
In the Thomas case, yes. What the court looked at is and broke down our four different definitions of fungibility or potential fungibility for a product. And what it found was that under the facts that had been presented in Thomas, that lead paint was fungible for the purposes of applying the risk contribution theory. What the defendants here, excuse me, the appellate's here mistake is, the right here is to access to the court to go in and fight your legal battle. That's what these lead poisoned children are entitled to. The Thomas Court made clear they're not entitled necessarily to a recovery, and in fact we saw in Mr. Thomas's case he didn't have a recovery. But what the right is they have the ability to go before a jury and put these questions of fact before a finder of fact and have a jury or, in cases of summary judgment, a court make a decision based on the factual record in their own case. So it's not a guaranteed recovery, but it's an access to the courts. They have the ability to bring a suit to resolve or address the wrongs that have been visited upon them. And what the Thomas Court found was that the facts as they exist for lead poisoning satisfy all of those prerequisites to allow children to bring their lawsuits. That's what this case is about, allowing children who are lead poisoned to bring their lawsuits against the product manufacturer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. If Stephen Thomas had a vested right in a cause of action pursuant to risk contribution for his lead poisoning in 1991 and 1993, then no serious argument can be made that Yasmin Clark didn't have a vested right to the same cause of action for her lead poisoning 10 years later. Defendant appellants do not argue that Thomas did not create a right to a cause of action in Stephen Thomas, because they can't. To do that, to make that argument, would be absurd. And the defendant appellants do not argue that the Thomas decision sunbursted its holding so as to apply it only to Stephen Thomas and prospectively to everybody else. Sunbursting is a tool available to the court when it chooses to apply it. That's when the Chevron criteria come into play. And this is because judicial opinions are presumptively retroactive. Everybody agrees that a right is vested when it has been so far perfected that it cannot be taken away by statute. And a right to a cause of action is a property right that is grounded in the right to the remedy clause in the Wisconsin Constitution, which is, according to the Croner versus Oneida Seven Nations Generations Corporation decision, both substantive in nature and guarantees access to Wisconsin courts to proceed on rights and remedies created by the Constitution, statute, or the common law. The private right of Yasmin Clark seeks to protect here today is a constitutional right of access to the courts to proceed on a remedy created in the common law pursuant to this court's rulings in Collins and in Thomas. And she seeks to protect that right after she relied on the Thomas decision by filing her case a year and a half later, after the Thomas case had been published and made part of the law of this state. And I might add that in the reply brief of the defendants, they erroneously assert that Yasmin Clark had filed her lawsuit in 2003 against landlords and then amended it in 2006 to bring in the industry. That is just wrong, factually wrong. But Yasmin Clark also spent 9.5 years of her life in litigation relying on the Thomas decision after spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in reliance on the validity of this court's explicit words in its published decision in Thomas, and after watching her case
almost arrive at trial. This case got to the point of we were within 1 month of the final pretrial conference. Yeah, I think it was 2 months before the trial when this happened. And if your honors would go back and look at the record, the transcript that is in the record of the hearing held by Judge, I think it was Judge Dugan, over the question of whether the Clark case should be stayed pending the appeal in Gibson. And in that hearing, counsel for the defendants said to Judge Dugan, there is legislation pending for the next day that's going to abrogate risk contribution. And it has within it a provision that would retroactively apply to the Clark case. Right? Judge Dugan declined that invitation. The stay was nevertheless granted. But Judge Dugan declined the invitation, and the next day the statute was amended to remove the retroactive provision that was in it at its start. So, now, despite these facts that are in the record, the defendants assert that there is no support for the trial court's conclusion that a judicial decision can retroactively vest a new right. That is the language that they use. I quoted, quote, there is no support for the trial court's conclusion that a judicial decision can retroactively vest a new right. That's in their opening brief at page 28. Now, the attempted logic of that proposition is that even though judicial decisions are presumptively retroactive, a judicial decision cannot retroactively confer a new right. This assertion suffers from a very simple and fundamental miscomprehension of what judicial decisions are and how they work. As recently Justice Ziegler in, I believe it was the Heritage Farms case, Heritage Farms versus Marco, which I guess had some statutory changes subsequent to that decision. But with respect to this question, and I'll quote from Justice Ziegler. Justice Ziegler wrote, the Blackstonian doctrine is based on the jurisprudential theory that courts declare but do not make law. In consequence, when a decision is overruled, it does not merely become bad law. It was never the law, and the later pronouncement is regarded as the law from the beginning. Therefore, judicial decisions are presumptively retroactive unless a court explicitly and specifically sunbursts its holdings for equity reasons. And that's always spelled out in the decision itself. And there is no case anywhere where sunbursting is retroactively done later to a case that had been issued by the court 10 years earlier.
I don't remember, but in Thomas, didn't somebody request that if you're going to change the law or apply it, it should be sunbursted?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I thought in Thomas the argument was made that if the court was going to accept the risk contribution theory, it should be sunbursted.
But the court did not do that.
That's right. Okay. That's right. But I think it was requested.
Yeah, it very well may have. I stood before this court back then, and my memory fails me. There is no doubt that the court chose not to do that.
Presumably, then, the argument consistent with today, the argument in Thomas was, court, unless you rely on the Wisconsin Constitution, you just can't come out our way. Is that how Thomas was argued? Thomas presumably then was argued, and I haven't looked at it, I haven't pulled the briefs, and I don't even know if we still have oral argument on it, but presumably back when you argued Thomas, you argued for this court to come out in your favor, then the court has to rely on the Wisconsin Constitution, because absent that, there's no way to rule in favor of Thomas. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. Article 1, Section 9 was fundamentally central to the, as a matter of fact, the way that case arrived in this court was that Judge Brown in District 1, when they sustained the trial court's granting of summary judgment, the issue before the trial court was whether the Thomas facts of lead-poisoned children who've ingested white lead carbonate were factually similar to the facts of the DES cases decided in Collins, because Collins had that imputation to apply to factually similar circumstances. And the appeals court, as well as Judge Dugan in Thomas, held that, well, no, Judge Dugan didn't hold this, but the appeals court did. The appeals court held that Thomas and lead poison, white lead carbonate cases were, in fact, factually similar to the DES cases in all respects except one, and that is the existence of an alternative remedy. And the appeals court ruled that Article 1, Section 9 did not apply because, unlike the DES cases, Stephen Thomas did not have an alternative remedy. Did have an alternative remedy. He had a remedy against the landlords. And Judge Brown said, well, he read the word or, sandwiched between the word injury and word wrong, in the right to a remedy clause, that he read that word in the disjunctive, meaning the Article 1, Section 9 applies to both, guarantees a remedy to both the injury and to all wrongs. Right? And that is exactly what the Supreme Court, this court, adopted in the Thomas decision, that in fact that word or is to be read in the disjunctive. And that is the interpretation upon which risk contribution, therefore, was applied to lead poisoned children. And that's why, as my colleague, Ms. Fitzpatrick, has pointed out, Thomas is constitutionally based. It's a constitutional right of access to the courts that is being obliterated in its entirety by this statute.
So, Mr. Earle, I understand that there are six children who filed and were okay with the first law that was passed in 2011, but are being ousted from their claims by the 2013 law. Are there any other children that you know of in Wisconsin that are waiting in the wings to file a lead carbonate lawsuit?
I know of no other children waiting in the wings, Your Honor. There are 171 children affected by this legislation. And if I may, Your Honor, I would take some, again, inaccuracies.
Just stop a minute. How can there be 171 children affected by this legislation? Is it because many of those children are not victims of lead carbonate? Am I understanding that right?
Maybe I misheard the question.
Okay. I'm trying to narrow down how many children did this statute affect. Okay. And I was told that there are six children who filed a lawsuit after Thomas before the law was changed. Okay? The law that was passed in 2011 didn't bother them because it was prospective. But there are six children who have filed lawsuits that the 2013 law would oust from their lawsuit that they've begun. Okay, and then you said to me, well, there are 171. Is the 171 a bigger number because some of those children who might want to bring a risk contribution claim are not relying on lead carbonate? I need you to straighten out that, if you know, and if you don't.
And I do, Your Honor. I just didn't hear the question the first time around for the echo. Yes. The facts are that there are a total of eight cases pending in the state courts of and federal courts of the state. Seven of those cases were filed before February 1, 2011. Those seven cases contain 171 children who are plaintiffs. Okay. What happened was, in the months before Act 2, which is the 2011 legislation, what happened there was that a single case was filed with 164 permissively joined plaintiffs in federal court. And there's a whole dialogue, actually, in...
How could this ever apply to any lead, if it's a constitutional right, how could any lead paint case be barred?
Well, this is Ms. Fitzpatrick's point, Your Honor, and I think that's a correct point because, you know, to build on that, I would argue that It cannot happen if the children are left remedyless. The legislature can tinker with risk contribution. It can modify any common law in the state of Wisconsin. That is their prerogative. It can pursue policy objectives, because that is their prerogative. But it cannot extinguish completely and totally what has been guaranteed by this court in Thomas.
So in any lead paint case, it is constitutionally available. It's a constitutional right to be able to bring a lawsuit against the industry and make them prove it's not their pigment that caused the injury.
Right. And the Thomas paradigm provides them with that opportunity. And I would point out that in the Clark case itself, as well as in the Thomas case, ConAgra was a defendant in both cases. And ConAgra was exculpated in both cases, pursuant to the exculpation defense that was provided in the Thomas paradigm. I think it was paragraph 64 of the decision. I might be wrong about that, but in that range. It was 160, 161 in the Thomas decision itself. But, Your Honor, I would like to add that we're presenting two arguments to this court. One is the ambitious argument that this is unconstitutional in its entirety as to lead poisoned children. The statute is. The legislature can go back and try and tinker with it and come up with a constitutional statute that does not completely extinguish the right to a remedy. And that's what Ms. Fitzpatrick was arguing. Now, what I'm arguing is that there was a vested right under substantive due process, and when that vested right is balanced against the public purpose, which my light's red, and I would like to be able to address it, but I guess
finish it, because I'm going to ask you to finish your answer.
Okay, yeah, that also is a constitutional bar to this statute on its face with regards to the retroactive provision in the statute on its face.
So you're saying your position, unlike counsel's position, is once you have a vested right, there can be a rational basis, but it can't overcome the vested right?
I think so. Okay. Let me articulate what I think I'm agreeing to here, and that is that the legislature can extinguish a vested right under substantive due process if it is in pursuit of a public policy that outweighs that vested right. Okay. But you will hear, if I'm permitted to discuss the balancing test, that the private right here is more than palpable, and the injury done to that private right is overly harsh, and in fact it's brutal, okay, in its consequences to the children, and the public purpose for the retroactive effect of the statute is weak.
If we agree with your argument, would it affect or permit other plaintiffs besides those involved in the seven cases you talked about to bring a claim?
That's a good question, Your Honor. Now, we're talking about the substantive due process
argument.
What
you're arguing, I know what she's saying. Yeah, because it's quite broad.
Yeah, because I don't want to tangle the two. Under substantive due process, the traditional analysis used by this court in Society Insurance and in Matthews and in Martin and so forth, that whole line of cases, right? Those turn on the retroactive impairment of a vested right, which, in the language of those cases, that accrued at the point of injury, the law at the time of injury,
yeah.
Right? And therefore, applying a substantive due process holding in this case would not only protect the claims of the seven cases that were filed beforehand and are pending, but it would also protect the rights of any child who was poisoned before February 1 of 2011. Right? And under substantive due process, children who were poisoned after February 1 of 2011 would be prospectively proscribed from bringing such claims, okay, under substantive due process. Does that address the question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. That's exactly my question.
All right. So, but I guess my point is, though, that as far as the nature of the right that Yasmin Clark had, it was not a new right. That was the miscomprehension that the defendants' appellants put into their logic here. It was a declaration of an existing right that was yielded by or provided by the Thomas decision. I'll go straight to the I had a bunch of other stuff I wanted to talk about, but I'm in red light time. And I have leave to discuss the balance.
Yeah, your red light is on, and I give you just a few minutes. I will also add on to your time a few minutes so that you have a right to respond to the time that he's over on.
Okay. Now, on the balance.
Yes, on the balance, Your Honor.
Just a minute.
I want to point out
the legislature attempted to make that balance, didn't they?
Yes, that's a remarkable assertion, because I suppose legislatures balance all sorts of things all the time in the course of making legislation, but that is not balancing in the course of a constitutional adjudication.
Well, that's
and that's what we have here.
That's my point. You're taking the position this court makes the balance, not the legislature.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why?
Because the kind of if this court were to defer to the legislature on the question, it would in effect be deferring to the legislature on the question of constitutional adjudication, because the balance is determinative of the constitutional rights. Look at what we have here. We have a vested property right that's constitutionally protected in the private individual. And on the public side and the public purpose side, we have a public policy decision that the legislature has arrived at to prescribe that private right. And as Society Insurance pointed out very clearly, is you cannot extinguish a constitutionally protected property right that's already vested without individualized consideration. I mean, you can't take a category of people and say, we're obliterating your rights, and you don't have a right to address that question or any due process right to enter the courtroom and say, wait a second, my right has some value. Please, let me protect my right. Yasmin Clark did not have that and was not provided that right under these facts, because look at what happened here. It was in the middle of the night on the last day in the Joint Finance Committee, and motion 999, buried in the bottom of that motion without a title or even notice that it was in there. You know, they obliterate all these rights. How can that comport with due process? It can't.
Well, doesn't that go with your argument that this is private legislation in regard to these children?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Doesn't that go with your argument that this is private legislation in regard to these children?
Well, it is private legislation with regards to these children, but it's also, it does great violence to their substantive due process rights. Because private legislation, what doesn't enter into the question on the private legislation is what happens to the children. Right? I mean, we've been talking here about Yasmin Clark's expectations in 2003. And Yasmin Clark had an expectation not to be poisoned. I mean, she had an expectation to be able to grow up and live her life with access to her full faculties. And these defendants were culpable in their conduct. They knew that lead poisoned children. And the court recognized this. The Thomas court recognized it and said, she has the right to adjudicate that. And that's what's being taken away here. I'll close with these notions. And that is that because I want to be clear about the weight that's involved with Yasmin Clark's private right here, and I've lost my place. Well, let me just say this. I mean, Yasmin Clark, her private rights, her private interests that are affected here, these are rights that are based on a justified reliance on this court's ruling. She pursued a lawsuit after this court ruled, wrote a decision that said she had this right. We've had years, and that was December 27 of 2006. We're sitting here today on April 5th of 2016. During this period of time, there have been hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on costs in pursuing that lawsuit. experts, dozens of experts, have been identified, filed reports, been deposed. Discovery was closed in the case. And after all of that, that justified reliance, that is what gets obliterated here. That has to weigh very heavily on the scales of consideration in conducting this balance. And when you look at the public policy for the retroactive application of the statute, no one can point to any fact that says the economy of Wisconsin has been bolstered by this legislation. No one can point to any fact that says that jobs have been created as a result of that. There is no and if you look at what Senator Grothman said during the hearing, where he was justifying this legislation, or predecessor of this legislation, to Senator Reiser, he said, why are you doing this? And the justification was, because it offends me. That's the only expression we have that narrowly addresses, why are you doing this retroactively? Because it offends me. That is the reason. With that, Your Honor.
Thank you. David Prosser.
Justice Prosser, please.
I want to make absolutely sure. The 171 victims are all lead paint victims?
Yes, they are all lead paint victims. And, Your Honor, I've run out of time, so I can't, but I'll point out that the alleged asbestos chemical solvent, if Your Honor would just simply go to...
That's all I need.
I point out R473 in the record that shows that's just incorrect.
So you, too, are asking for a limited decision dealing only with lead paint?
Yes.
Thank you. Let me see, before you begin and we turn the timer on here. Okay, so you should have 5 minutes in rebuttal, so I'll give you 10 minutes. How's that? Kevin, can you fix the clock for him? Thank you.
That's mine. I thought yours is down here. Thank you, Your Honor. Couple of things I want to address. First off, the number of plaintiffs. We had 171 WLC lawsuits or claimants that came in before the effective date of the 2011 Act. There are also cases related to benzene and solvents and asbestos that also exist. And in addition, there's a case called Vallejo, which deals with a claim that accrued before the effective date. So in the case of latent injuries or minors, the plaintiff's position is that those lawsuits can continue to be filed, even though we have a statute on file that says prospectively you can't bring these claims. There are potentially tens of thousands more cases out there. And that's what the senator was suggesting was offending him, that we have a legislative intent to resolve this issue, and yet there's this gigantic loophole in which these claims continue to get filed and can continue to be filed for generations to come. Now, I want to address most specifically Article 1, Section 9, and I'd like to take the Court's attention to paragraph 129. In paragraph 129, the Court does...
Of what?
Of Thomas. The Court does not state we're making a decision based on Article 1, Section 9. It says, although Article 1, Section 9 itself may not create new rights, it does allow for a remedy through the existing common law. And the contention was that Article 1, Section 9 does not bar the court from moving forward because there's a landlord case out there, but that it allows the court continue to modify the common law. And in fact, if the court goes to paragraph 131, they make the same point. And previously, the court says that Collins is a common law decision. So the idea that this is somehow a constitutional decision is simply not correct. And if taken to its logical end, what the plaintiffs are contending is that any legislation that addresses risk contribution, including the 2011 Act, it would be unconstitutional, and that's simply extraordinary and not consistent with the court's opinions in both Collins and in Thomas.
That certainly is the broader brush that they would like us to paint with. I think Attorney Earle's brush is more focused, and I'm wondering if you could tell me why the balance that we are to do is not
very, very subjective. You tried, I think, a little bit the last time, but I'm still concerned that it's quite a subjective balance, or I guess maybe our...
Your Honor, there is some subjectivity there, which is why this court has created the tests it has, which is to say that unless the plaintiff proves beyond a reasonable doubt that the statute is irrational, it should be affirmed. And so the legislature, when it creates a statute, when it creates a common or abrogates a common law rule and creates a new rule, that should be deferred to. And in this instance, and as a matter of comedy,
that's perspective, I think you're right, and I think our court tries very hard to follow the rational basis rationale when a statute that's prospectively is challenged. I see it somewhat different when it's a retrospective statute.
Well, this court in Society Insurance in footnote 9 says that this, or I'm sorry, footnote 12 says that this is a retro, that the retroactive legislation is looked at as a rational basis. And what it says, is that you have to look at what's the rational basis for applying it retroactively. And so in a lot of the cases like Martin and in Matthews, there's no application why it has to go backwards. Why does it have to apply retrospectively? There's nothing that the legislature says. There's no indication of it. Here, what the legislature was doing was restoring the common law back to what it was prior to Thomas. And what it's saying is that this legislation won't be effective unless it gets restored back to that common law, because we have this loophole in which potentially tens of thousands of new lawsuits may be filed, and it's not just claims of white lead carbonate. There are claims related to benzene and asbestos and stuff, and it can apply, Thomas can apply broadly to a lot of different products. And so legislative intent would be completely abrogated. And these are exactly the type of cases that the court in Kopech versus City of Elmhurst said is fine, that when there is a need to close that gap, that the legislature is acting rationally when it applies retroactively. That's a good reason for applying it backwards. And particularly here, when you're dealing with...
So is that the public purpose that we're supposed to look at? The need? We should apply it retroactively?
That is absolutely one of the public purposes, is to give to effect to that legislative intent. The Wisconsin legislature did not need to wait for a harm to happen to the state or to the state economy in order to set policy that it believed was appropriate for the state. And in setting that policy, and look, it's no surprise, tort law drives where companies manufacture, where they're going to create new jobs, where they're going to set things forth. That's empirically been proven. And legislature here can recognize that when this court decided the case in Thomas, the Wall Street Journal ran a newspaper article saying this is the Alabama North, that trial lawyers are going to come into this state, and it's going to be
a
different situation.
Excuse me, counsel, I'm interested in the balance, not in the newspaper.
But Your Honor,
what I want to know is, what do you see as the balance on the other side of the scale? Now, you told me what you think the state's balance is. When they enacted this, what's the balance on the other side, the side of the children that have been poisoned? What's their balance?
And Your Honor, the newspapers are relevant. Northwest Airlines, this court looked at things like that in making its decision.
Well,
putting
that
balance.
They like.
But on the other side, this is not a case where lead poisoned or allegedly children are allowed denied access to the courts. They can bring their lawsuit. They merely have to meet the same burden of proof that the other plaintiffs have had to prove for the last 150 years. And in this case, this is not a case where products were indistinguishable from one another. White lead manufacturers advertised their products. They sold their products under brand names that the painters who were partaking the white lead carbonate knew what they were buying. The problem is that we're going back over 100 years and are trying to apply a liability to something. Now, intact lead paint is not a hazard. And so what you have is a situation in which a product, if it's well-maintained for the last 100 years, is not a harm under the law of Wisconsin and under federal law. It's when it deteriorates, when it is not in control of these defendant manufacturers. It's deteriorating. So the problem is not that this is not that you're not able to tell who these defendants are who created the harm, but that the passage of time of 100 years makes it virtually impossible to do so. There have been a number of cases, I think at least two or three, in which plaintiffs have identified a product manufacturer in other states, and they could bring those claims forward. It is hard, not because of the product, but because of the passage of time. And that's exactly, and that's not an excuse to change the law retroactively to go back and allow that to happen. And in addition, you have to look at this right in Thomas was very unsettled. And I know we've gone over it before, but as of 2013, it wasn't like a statute of limitations. It wasn't like a cap on economic damages. It was something much more amorphous. And the plaintiffs could have gone all the way through trial, and the court could have said, this violates public policy. We don't want to apply this to a law to these remote harms, or this is disproportional liability. That happens under this court's law. And those were one of the questions that were left open by this court in Thomas. And so to suggest that it was somehow settled and over, I think is wrong. But certainly it is outweighed by the economic interests and the public policy that the state put forward and the interests of the manufacturers.
What do you think the holding in Thomas is?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
What do you think the holding in Thomas is?
The holding in Thomas was that risk contribution may be able to apply to white lead carbonate if certain things were met. And one of those open issues was fungibility, which has never been decided to this day, whether white lead is actually fungible. The court construed the record in favor of the plaintiffs and disregarded the contrary evidence to the defendants because it was up on summary judgment. But that does not make it applicable to white lead carbonate. It has never been decided in a decision by this court.
Well, you also, if I understood your argument, thought that Thomas was not based on Article 1, Section 9.
That is correct, Your Honor. It's a common law decision.
Common law decisions can rely on the Constitution, can't they?
What this court did is it looked at Article 1, Section 9 for the authority to abrogate the common law that had existed at the time. And it said this Article 1, Section 9 gives the judiciary the power to create a common law remedy for this situation. It did not say it was constitutionally required. It expressly says it is a common law remedy, which can be abrogated by the legislature. Justice Ziegler, I would like to point out one case that I hadn't mentioned to you when you said, what about the settled expectations that we talked about before, is Boykin versus Boeing, which deals with an instance where there is that gap, and you look to when the injury occurred. And it's important here, vested rights, I think there are many ways that this court can resolve this decision, but vested rights is critically important. We had a conference call in another case on Friday in which the plaintiffs have said what this court does today doesn't matter because federal due process claims are out there, and that they're going to bring those federal due process claims. And vested rights resolves that case. It puts to bed Thomas and allows this legislature to stand and put this chapter behind us, and it's critically important. But we also believe that if the court balances the interests at hand here, that there's no question that the balance comes out in favor of the defendant manufacturers.
In which federal court are you before, district or court of appeals?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Which federal court?
District.
District. East? West?
Eastern.
Thank you very much. Anybody else have a question? Justice Bradley, do you have a question?
The Gibson court didn't agree with the argument that you're advancing now, that this is unexpected or unsettled premise. It says, one final point on the due process challenge to Thomas. The Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision was not, and quote, unexpected and indefensible break from Wisconsin prior common law. As discussed earlier, Thomas's foundation in Wisconsin common law was Collins. The Wisconsin Supreme Court applied the same rationale in Collins as in Thomas, recognizing for DES cases the same balancing between the culpable set of defendants and the innocent plaintiff. I read that, I guess, in part to indicate that there's at least one authority, of course that's not binding on us, that, for want of a better legal phrase, poo-poos your argument that it was unexpected or
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, to begin with, I think Gibson was, to be blunt, rather superficial in its analysis of this issue. It referred back only to two cases, and it largely looked to the circuit court's decision in this very case. And so it's very circular. It said the Clark trial court decided it this way, and we sort of agree, and we look at these two cases and come back. So it's a very superficial analysis. I think that when one looks at Collins was a very unique situation that dealt with the signature injury. It dealt with a well-defined market. It dealt with a time period of only 9 months. And the court said in Collins, if there are factually similar cases, that this type of risk contribution theory could apply. This is not that type of case. We're dealing
with... I guess that's what we're wrangling about in many ways. Well, how similar is it?
I don't think it's very similar at all. I mean, the first two cases in Thomas, the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, both denied to apply risk contribution because they said it's not similar at all to Collins. And what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with a time period that extends well over 100 years. We're dealing with manufacturers who come into the market for limited time periods, who have a very small market share. I mean, the largest market share entities in this case don't exist. They're not here in these lawsuits that have sometimes over 90% of the market share in a given year. They aren't defendants in this case. We're dealing with smaller defendants who could be disproportionately liable for a massive amount of different years and products that other people manufactured.
I only point that out to indicate that there's disagreement with you on that, and then they analyze why they disagree.
And Your Honor, I think the signature injury...
Maybe superficial, as you say. I'm not going to be quick to cast those aspersions. But
it's also important to look at the fact that there was no signature injury here and that there is lead from a number of different sources, including other lead paints that may exist, lead dryers and other lead pigments that exist that are not white lead carbonate. So it's a completely different situation.
Thank you very much.
Wait a minute. You don't agree with Gibson, do you?
No, Your Honor. We think it was wrongly decided.
And is it binding on us?
No, Your Honor. No, Your Honor.
No. It just overturned the trial court, the district court.
Correct.
All right. Thank you. Well, thank you all for a really vigorous argument. It's a very, very, very interesting case. Thank you so much. We are adjourned.